Well, good morning, Mendocino. This is Jeff Blankford welcoming you to the July 8th edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month, and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to you, our listeners. You may have heard of what is thought to be an ancient Chinese curse: may you live in interesting times. It is neither Chinese nor ancient, apparently dating no further back than 1936, when it was introduced by a friend of a British diplomat who was setting off on an assignment in China a year before it was invaded by Japan. And the original words were, may you live in an interesting age. Be it times or age, what the world is now experiencing is as interesting and fraught with horrors as it was back in 1936. To add to the unending bloodshed in Syria and to a lesser extent Iraq, we have a newly aggressive Saudi Arabia, a close U.S. ally, which created and funded al-Qaeda in Afghanistan back in 1979 and funded and armed its latest incarnation in Syria, part of which morphed into Daesh, or ISIS, whose reign of terror has no borders. For months now, the Saudis have been utilizing U.S.-supplied intelligence and F-16 jet fighters and missiles purchased from Lockheed Martin to indiscriminately bomb neighboring Yemen. They are doing so, they say, in order to reverse a successful Shia-led insurrection against the U.S. and Saudi-backed regime, which it claims was instigated by Iran. Calls by human rights groups to get the Saudis to stop the bombing, even to allow humanitarian aid to enter the country, have fallen on deaf ears, and Washington has done nothing to stop the carnage. Meanwhile, the media consigns the story to its back pages, if it reports it at all. More attention has been focused on the Saudis' neighbor Iran and the negotiations with the P5+1 nations, led by the U.S., that were supposed to be concluded yesterday in Vienna, but have been extended to Friday. Whatever the short-term results of those talks, the powerful pro-Israel establishment is working around the clock to make sure that in the end they are unsuccessful, even if that means having the U.S. launch another Middle East war on Israel's behalf. In the forefront of those efforts is the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, or WINEP. Indeed, it was created 30 years ago for such moments by the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, or AIPAC, although the media never mentions its origins, and today it has become so powerful that it is being treated by some in the same media as if it was a fourth branch of government. Led by the ubiquitous Dennis Ross from WINEP's leadership team, the Institute recently collected a, quote, bipartisan working group of so-called experts who prepared a policy paper that effectively tells Secretary of State Kerry and the P5+1 negotiators what Iran must be required to do to have some of the sanctions against it lifted, such as allowing inspectors on demand of any to enter on demand of any Iranian military base and interviewing Iranian scientists and government officials about Iran's past nuclear activities. In sum, they are demanding what amounts to total stripping of Iran's sovereignty, something no country that has not been defeated in war would agree to. They affirm that should be an agreement be signed, and Iran appeared to be on the threshold of building a nuclear weapon, which a number of these experts have been long accused of being ready to do, the United States must go on record now that it is committed to using all means necessary, including military force, to prevent this. The president, they wrote, should declare this to be a U.S. policy and Congress should formally endorse it, end quote. What the postponement of the signing of the agreement to Friday means is that Congress will now have 60 days to review it instead of 30 days, which would have been the case if it was signed by tomorrow. Given that all the signatories of the statement have been identified as strong supporters of Israel, the fact that they can make these demands while saying not a word about Israel's estimated 300 nuclear weapons, some of which are on submarines off Iran's shores, may be the ultimate in chutzpah. This is a battle that is not even close to being over. In Greece, some 1,800 miles by air to Iran's west, the people, given a rare opportunity to cast a vote that would impact all their lives, overwhelmingly rejected the demands of Germany and the European Central Bank that they accept further austerity, in exchange for the bank providing their government with the funds to make up the IMF on a loan that they had no part in securing. The decision to let the people decide was made by Greece's president, Alex Tsipras, who had been elected on the promise that he would not bow to the demand of the country's Eurozone partners that Greeks submit to further hardships, and he kept that promise. Can one imagine President Obama letting the people vote on whether or not the U.S. should participate in the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement? He won't even let the public or the media know what it contains, and members of Congress who have been allowed to see it are not permitted to talk about it. A fine democracy this is. Well, that agreement, what is known about it, thanks to revelations by WikiLeaks, is what I will be exploring at about 20 minutes past the hour when I speak with Patrick Woodall, the research director and senior policy advocate for Food and Water Watch, who has been carefully monitoring TPP's progress. In the meantime, let's briefly take a look at some of these other crises from a perspective you are not likely to get from our national media. Let's start with Ukraine, where Russian President Vladimir Putin is being demonized by the U.S. media, as was every Russian president under the Soviet Union, until Mikhail Gorbachev effectively destroyed it, throwing in the towel, declaring glasnost. Putin is no angel, of course, but as my guest Robert Perry pointed out 2 weeks ago, in the conflict over Ukraine, there are no white hats or black hats, only gray ones. Since then, someone sent me an unusual clip from C-SPAN's coverage of UN Ambassador Samantha Power's testimony before the House Foreign Affairs Subcommittee last month on Europe, Eurasia, and emerging threats. In the clip, which runs just under 3.5 minutes, Power is challenged by the committee chair, 13-term Republican congressman from Orange County, Dana Rohrabacher, a former speechwriter for President Reagan. I thought you should hear it.
I'd like to ask you a little bit about Ukraine. Do you, you were mentioning the people who were shelled, your family that you know, that are you described being shelled by the Soviet, or excuse me, Russian allies there in Ukraine. How many civilians have died since this whole incident began, do you know?
6,300 is the official number, but we think there's underreporting because the separatists don't allow access.
Well, of that 6,300, how many were separatists in separatist towns and villages?
That I don't know offhand.
You know, I want to tell you, I don't. When I asked that question, almost nobody knows. But it was my understanding. I went over to Europe and met with some very people involved in intelligence agencies in various countries, and they were telling me that actually, in the Ukrainian military, which was one-third made up of people who were not in their military but were instead on the payroll of some oligarch, they had heavy artillery and were indiscriminately shelling these separatist villages. Do you know anything about that?
First, let me actually correct what I said earlier. You asked how many civilians have been killed.
Right.
To my knowledge, the 6,300 figure that we have is both civilian and soldiers. So let me also get you the breakdown on actual civilians, if it exists. One of the issues that I raised in Ukraine in my visit was how critical it is for the Ukrainians to abide by international humanitarian law. It's absolutely critical.
Okay.
And it's critical for hearts and minds as well as for law.
Is it possible that the majority of the civilian casualties that you're talking about were actually civilian casualties that were the victims of the Ukrainian army and the oligarch that financed one-third of their army at one point? Is that possible?
If I could say two things. First, I think it's highly unlikely on the basis of the reports that we've received from the United Nations and from the OSCE. Second, I want to underscore again why this conflict started. It started because Russia moved troops weapons and so forth into Eastern Ukraine.
Just so you know, Madam Secretary, the Russians would suggest it started when there was a violent overthrow of an elected government.
Right. I don't make it a point of listening to President Putin's claims as a general rule. I don't find
it credible. Well, I think if you are our representative, you should pay attention to everybody's claims, and you should refute them if they can be refuted rather than dismissing them. Because I happen to believe that if that coup, meaning violent overthrow of a
violent
overthrow of an elected government had not happened, we would not be in this situation, and the Ukrainians would have been spared this. But are you, and you can go beyond that to where our European allies didn't offer Yanukovych the deal that he wanted and the response that most people in Ukraine have. They don't like Russia and they didn't want to be in an agreement with Russia. There are a lot of things that led up to this. It didn't start with Russia going into the separatist areas. That's not where it started. At least that's what they claim.
And that was Dana Rohrabacher questioning Samantha Power, but doing so with obvious hesitancy. He's a lifelong libertarian, not a neocon, and his take on Ukraine and Russia is something you're not likely to hear on NPR or read in our papers of record. One report I recall from earlier accounts of Greece's financial crisis was the involvement of Wall Street giant Goldman Sachs. So I went hunting for the story and found it in Germany's Der Spiegel from February 8, 2010. According to the article, Goldman Sachs helped the Greek government mask the true extent of its deficit 13 years ago with the help of a derivatives deal that legally circumvented the European Union Maastricht deficit rules. At the time, various investment banks offered complex financial products with which governments could push part of their liabilities into the future, one insider recalled to Der Spiegel, and then Mediterranean countries had snapped them up. Thus it was that Greece's debt managers agreed to a huge deal with Goldman Sachs at the start of 2002. It involved so-called cross-currency swaps, in which government debt issued in dollars and yen was swapped for a euro debt for a certain period, to be exchanged back into the original currencies at a later date. Goldman Sachs devised a special kind of swap with fictional exchange rates that enabled Greece to receive a far higher sum than the actual euro market value of $10 billion or yen. This secret deal provided an additional credit of up to $1 billion for the Greeks, and since it was disguised as a swap, it didn't show up in the Greek debt statistics, since the reporting rules largely ignored financial derivatives. At some point, predicted the author of the article, Greece would have to pay for its swap transactions, and that would impact its deficit. The bonds he wrote would mature in between 10 and 15 years. It is now 13 years later, and they have come due. As for Goldman Sachs, it charged a high commission rate for the deal and skipped out, selling the swaps to a Greek bank in 2005. Closer to home, on the island in the Caribbean that the Spanish named Hispaniola, and which has long been the home to two nations with very different histories, Haiti and the Dominican Republic. The Dominicans have begun a process that can only be described as the ethnic cleansing of close to 500,000 Haitians or who are of Haitian ancestry going back to 1929. The Dominican government has demanded that all Haitians in the country register with the government or face deportation to Haiti. Out of an estimated 450,000 Haitians on that part of the island, some 200,000 registered by the June 17th deadline, but reportedly less than 2% have been given legal residence. That deadline reportedly has been extended. Well, if this happens and there's mass deportation, it might be the first time that Haitians have been expelled from the Dominican Republic. In 1937, the dictator Rafael Trujillo ordered the massacre of tens of thousands of them, and the Haitians, knowing that history, fear a mass violent deportation to their wounded country, still suffering from the catastrophic 7.0 earthquake in 2010 that spared the Dominican Republic, whose border was far from the quake's epicenter. The problem had its origin in a bill passed by the Dominican Constitutional Assembly in 2013 that took away the citizenship born in the country to foreign parents, but that vote may have received its impetus from a decision by the United States in 2007 to assist in setting up a Dominican version of the U.S. Border Patrol called CESFRONT. Since 2007, the U.S. has provided CESFRONT with extensive training, equipment, and facilities, including a firing range, fingerprinting and electronic surveillance systems, and at least one of several drones now being deployed around the Dominican Republic's borders. Finally, last Friday, as is tradition on July 4th, on the day before, if the holiday falls on Saturday, as it did this year, NPR's Morning Edition presents all of us hosts and far-flung correspondents doing a dramatic reading of the Declaration of Independence. Apart from the fact that this nation's founding fathers did not consider all men to have been created equal, something the country has come to live with, there is a section that comes along about 6 minutes into the reading that tells a story as sorry a tale about our history to the present day as does the flying of the Confederate flag. Here it is in a moment, read by Ari Shapiro.
He has excited domestic insurrections amongst us and has endeavored to bring on the inhabitants of our frontiers, the merciless Indian savages, whose known rule of warfare is an undistinguished destruction of all ages, sexes, and conditions.
So that was Ari Shapiro talking about the savages and not the genocide. This past Saturday, I had hoped that this would be mentioned when NPR's Director of Standards and Practices, Mark Memmott, spoke with Professor Stephen Lucas from the University of Wisconsin about the meaning of words in the Declaration of Independence text. Lucas focused on the importance of the word facts used by the Declaration's authors in presenting their case against George, King George, to the world. But apparently, depicting Native Americans as savages presented no problem. Sadly, this is consistent with the fact that the history of the genocide of the indigenous peoples of this continent, whose lands our ancestors stole and which today we occupy, has never been truthfully told or taught in our public schools or acknowledged by any U.S. president. It's not that the history was unknown. In 1881, Helen Hunt Jackson, whose novel Ramona, 3 years later, dramatized the federal government's mistreatment of Native Americans in Southern California after the Mexican-American War, and was estimated to have been reprinted 300 times, hoped to educate her fellow Americans about the nature of the crimes that had been committed against Native Americans. In the introduction to her book, A Century of Dishonor, published by Harper and Brothers 134 years ago, she wrote, quote, "The history of the United States government's repeated violations of faith with the Indians thus convicts us as a nation not only of having outraged the principles of justice, which are the basis of international law, and having laid ourselves open to the accusations of both cruelty and perfidy, but of having made ourselves liable to all punishments which follow upon such sins, to arbitrary punishment at the hands of any civilized nation who might see fit to call us to account, and to that more certain natural punishment which sooner or later as surely comes from evil-doing as harvests come from sown seed." Those were the words of Helen Hunt Jackson from her book, A Century of Dishonor, published in 1881. Needless to say, the United States has long operated in the belief that no nation can call us into account, and so far that has been the case. A Century of Dishonor has been republished in an inexpensive Dober paperback, which I'm sure any of our local bookstores would be happy to order for you if they don't already stock it.